Okay. We're starting Perek Bet, and typically I teach from this website, or as a text from alatorah.org. I just find it's if you're not familiar with it and you're a student of Tanakh, in any way, it's an amazing resource because it actually gives me the full access to a Mikra'ot Gedolot in a very online user-friendly format. I can go pasuk by pasuk and look at the Mefarshim, and it's really quite extensive. It's a beautiful website. It's called alhatorah.org. However, in this case, it's going to become a little tedious for us in places because a good chunk of Sefer Daniel is written in Aramaic, starting in Perek Bet. And so this is really my opportunity to introduce to how we're going to operate this study of Daniel. My goal is to learn the story, the material, and discuss it. And so there's some nuance in the language, and there's sometimes we'll refer to the language itself, but I'm less kind of married to the question of the language in which the text was written. So what I have done is prepared this text, which is the original Aramaic column, the right-hand column, a very good translation into Hebrew. Aramaic to Hebrew is a very easy transition translation because the grammatical structure of them is almost identical. And so unlike translating Hebrew into English where you get ambiguity, from Aramaic to Hebrew is much easier to do, although there's still some interpretation, room for interpretation. But so what I've prepared is a Hebrew translation of the Aramaic sections. And as a text, our primary text, I'm actually going to work off the Hebrew translation, but it also has the English translation as well. So I just find this kind of layout easier to navigate. There is the equivalent option in Al HaTorah. Here's the Aramaic. Here is the Hebrew, and I can open up a third box, and there's your Hebrew translation, but it doesn't scroll as easily. It's a little bit more cumbersome to work with. So you'll forgive me for getting technical, but I'm just trying to deal with the context. All right, we are moving into Perek Bet, Chapter 2, for today. And my goal for today is to begin to look at this parak from the storyline, if you will, the framework of the story of the parak, beginning, middle, a little bit of the end, but there's a dream in the middle of this story, and the substance of that dream is a subject unto itself, so we're kind of going to skip over it and come back to it in the later weeks of this series. So we're at Shnat Shtayim L'Malchut Nebuchadnezzar. The second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Chalam Nebuchadnezzar Chalamot. Nebuchadnezzar began to dream. Now, right away, that should set off a flag. It's very unlikely that this is in year two of Nebuchadnezzar, because year two of Nebuchadnezzar is prior to the whole introduction of Nebuchadnezzar and the Yakim, etc. It's unlikely Daniel is, it's kind of jumps, puts us in a place that does not make a lot of sense. So we'll address that question at a later shiur. Why does it say year two? But most Mefarshim agree that year two here refers to the second year after the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash. So we kind of look at the time frame in Sefer Daniel as the initial, last week we talked about, or 2 weeks ago, we talked about chapter one, which occurs in the third year of the rebellion of Jehoiakim, meaning the attempted independence of the state of Israel, the kingdom of Israel, that fails. And now we're moved into a post-Churban experience. Daniel and his friends, a little bit older, they're kind of operating in Bavel, and the following story takes place. Chalam Nebuchadnezzar chalamot. Nebuchadnezzar had very disturbing dreams. Batit ba'emrucho. He was vexed. His spirit was troubled. He was very bothered by his dreams. Ushnatoni etalav. His sleep broke from him, meaning he couldn't sleep because of these dreams. So the king commanded, called over all the magicians and enchanters and sorcerers and Chaldeans and what have you, to tell the king what his dreams were. Meaning, and this is very important for us, the goal here was to report to the king what his dreams were and their meaning. Because the dream itself had eluded him. They came before the king. King said to them, "Chalom chalamti, I dreamt a dream. Vatipaem ruchi, and my spirit is greatly troubled. Ladat et chalom, to know what this dream was, I can't recall it. I know it was troublesome. I know it was bothersome, but I can't recall the dream." So here is where it shifts. If you look at the Pasuk Dalet in the original, Vayidabru kazim lemelech aramit, that the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, which was their mother tongue, and therefore the text now shifts to Aramaic, Malka la'almin. Right? So we're going to shift from here into the middle column, which is the Hebrew translation. Hamelech lalamim chie, long live the king. You tell us the dream, we'll be happy to interpret it. The king said to the Chaldeans, I can't do that because I don't have the dream. It's fleeted. How many of us dream at night, wake up in the morning, and 5 minutes after we had this extraordinary dream which we woke up from, we can't recall the details. Dreams disappear. They disappear into the ether. They just put your hands up. You can't. So naturally, he says, I don't remember the dream. I remember that I was disturbed by it. But don't play games with me. If you don't tell me the dream and its interpretation, we will cut you into pieces. And we'll turn your houses into dunghill. Lesson learned here. Do not cross Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is the most powerful human being on the planet. He is ruling one of the largest empire ever created in history at that time. If he says, you tell me the dream, you tell me the dream. If he says how high to jump, you jump. Otherwise, you forfeit your life. It's a simple equation. But if you will tell me the dream and its interpretation, hachalom ve'pitrono, then matanot tshuot v'chavot rab tekablu milfanai, I will give you great gifts and reward and honor. Ela et hachalom ve'pitrono agidu li. You need to tell me the dream and its interpretation. So a second time they said to the king, you have to give these soothsayers and magicians and advisors and whatever you have here, you have to give them credit for trying. Hamelech et hachalom yomar la'avadav et pitrono nagid. You tell us the dream, we'll be happy to interpret it. What's going through the minds of the advisors at this moment? A second time, when he says to them, you tell us the dream and we'll interpret it. He's already said no twice.
They're terrified.
They're very terrified. But not only are they terrified,
they're going to have to create him.
Maybe they think he's tricking them.
Right. I think they think he's playing a game with them. He's testing them. Because if he wasn't testing them, if he really didn't know the dream, then just repeating the request was going to be meaningless. In fact, there are some of the Mefarshim, Rabbanel, who claims that he was playing games with them, that he really did remember the dream and he was just playing the game with them. I don't think that most of the Mefarshim reject that as pshat. They all agree that he actually forgot the dream. But nonetheless, Onah Melech Meomer, Nachon Yadea Anochi, Kizmanatem Konim, I understand. You were looking to buy time. I get that. Here's the expression, by the way, to buy time, if you want to know where it comes from. As clearly you understand that I don't have the dream to tell you. If you don't tell me this dream, there's only one judgment for you. Umashchat hitkonantem lemor lefanai ad shezman yishtaneh. Right? You are trying to play the game, to corrupt with words until I change my mind. And you tell me the dream and I will know if you were telling the truth. So Kasdim said to the king, there's no human being alive who could do what you ask. No king has ever made such a request of his advisors that we should tell you not only the interpretation of the dream, but what it was that you dreamt itself. This matter is very difficult. There is no other person who can tell the king what he is asking. This could only be done by God or gods who dwell not with flesh. Meaning, you're asking us for something that the human being can't know. At that point, Nebuchadnezzar got very angry, and made a declaration to wipe out all of the men, wise men of Babel. And wipe them all out. If you're familiar with Megillat Esther, which is written more or less in a contemporary environment, language, you'll recognize some of the Hebrew words, dat, Rabbi dat niknav shishana bira, so law, decree from the king, yatzah me'achamim ne'ragim, and the wise men were being slain, or were to be slain, v'yamdu Daniel v'chaverav le'areg, including Daniel and his friends were part of this group. It's not clear that they were there. It's clear that they weren't in the inner circle when the king was talking to his advisors, but they are part of the group that Nebuchadnezzar has now set his sights on to be accountable for what Nebuchadnezzar sees as their failure. As had Daniel heishiv etzav atam l'aryoch sar ha-tabachim shel ha-melech, asher yatza la'arog et chachmei Bavel. Daniel turned and sought counsel from Arioch, who was the king's guard, Sar HaTabachim, and he asked him to, who was assigned the task of executing all of the Chachmei Babel. And he said, what is this all about? Onev omer l'Arioch, ha-mumuneh shel ha-melech, lama dat azza milifnei ha-melech? What is the reason for this terrible decree from the king? So Arioch reported to Daniel that the king is angry because he had a dream and nobody can tell what the dream was, let alone what it means. But Daniel nichnas ubikesh min ha-melech ki yiten lo zman ve'et ha-pitaron yagid la-melech. So Daniel goes in and he asks for a special amount of time so that he can do what the king has asked, not only to give him the interpretation, but the actual dream itself. Daniel comes to the king and he says, my dear king, I can do it. I can do it. Hold the execution. I can do it. But you just got to give me time. Okay. Does Daniel have an inside track that we don't know, that he's going to be able to tell Nebuchadnezzar his dream? It's called tefillah. Zay Daniel levito alach. Daniel goes to his house. And he told his friends what's going on. By the way, open parentheses, just note in your mind, how are Daniel and his friends identified here? Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. What happened to Belshazzar, Meshach, Sheshach, Abednego? That's not a name they want to be identified with. That's for others to address them as, if so be it, they remain with their Hebrew names. Berachamim levakesh milifnei Elokei HaShemayim ala Razazet, and to seek God's compassion, to tell them this great secret, Haraz, shelo yivdu Daniel v'chareav mishach chachmei Bavel, and be able to spare the lives of Daniel and his friends and the rest of the chachmei Bavel. And in fact, azay nigla Haraz le Daniel b'chazion alayla. That night, Daniel has a vision. And in that vision, he's told the dream and its interpretation, or at least the dream and the interpretation is self-evident. And that starts the story. Daniel comes to Nebuchadnezzar. We'll jump to the end of the parak in a minute, where he comes to Nebuchadnezzar to report on this dream. Before he does so, while still at night, after having received this vision, Azai Berach Daniel et Elokei HaShemayim, Daniel offers a tefillah. Oned Daniel v'yomer. Ehi Shem Elokim v'vorach min olam v'ad ha'olam. Very sound familiar? Right? Lehevi Shmei de'olam v'vorach min alma v'ad alma. Asher ha'chachma v'agvura shaloi. The core phrase of Kaddish is based on this. There's a lot of language here that will eventually come back to. And he offers a tefillah, Mishanaitim, Ismanim, Ezbim, Melachim, Akim, Melachim. I'll come back to this tefillah. We're going to study this tefillah as a separate discussion. But he offers a tefillah of Hodah to Kaddish Baruch Hu for having given him this message. Okay? Skip down to Pasuk of Dalet. Everything I skip, we're going to go back to. I just want to get the framework of the story for today. Daniel goes to Arioch, who is kind of executing the Chachamim as we speak. He says to him, don't kill the wise men of Babel. Hold the execution. You bring me to the king. I've got the answer. Ayoch quickly brings Daniel to the king. Matzati ish mibnei galut Yehuda asher yodiat pitron lemelech. I found somebody from the exiles of Judah who can give the king what he seeks. Ana melech v'melech Daniel asheshma Belshazzar yishcha yochol odieni et halom asher aiti v'pitrono. Daniel, the Nebuchadnezzar says to Daniel, can you do it? Belshazzar, can you really tell me the dream and its interpretation? This secret that the king is asking for, there are no magicians and soothsayers and astrologers and necromancers and whatever have you who could possibly tell the king what he dreamt. However, before you go and bring back the executioner, Yesh Eloah Bashaman, Migaler Azim, there is a God in heaven, and he reveals secrets. And he has told Nebuchadnezzar through this dream what the end of days is going to look like. This is the dream and the visions that upon your head, the dreams that you have considered, this is them. And this is the description of the dream. You king, your thoughts came into your mind while you were upon your bed. What the future will bring. You were considering, you were wondering what the future destiny of your nation is going to be. And you know what? God, who reveals the secrets, informed you what they will be. I don't come to you with any particular great wisdom and understanding in this matter. He that reveals secrets was come to tell you what you seek to know. Okay. This is what you saw. Now I'm going to skip from here because what he actually dreamt is much more complex than a shear or two by itself. So we're going to skip the whole dream. Daniel reports the dream and he reports the interpretation and the vision all the way to Achrit Yamim, the great Machut Shemayim that will last forever, the destruction of Bavel and all that that entails. We will come back to all of that at a later time. I'm going to jump straight to the end of the parak. Pasuk Mem Vav. Azai HaMelech Nebuchadnezzar Nafal HaPanah Nebuchadnezzar heard all of this. He fell on his face. Ule Daniel sagad, and he began to bow or worship Daniel. And he began to bring offerings and offering of meal offerings, etc., to him. Your God is the true God. And your master is the true master. Who reveals secrets. Because you were able to reveal this secret. So he gave Daniel a position of great stature and he gave him great presents. And he made him a ruler over or responsible for the affairs of much of the ruler over large sections of Babel, Varavs, Kanim, Al Kol, Chachmei Babel, and chief of the wise men of Babel. But Daniel became a Melech Yeman Avodat Medinat Babel at Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. Once Daniel is there, he said, you know what, I have three really good workers. Let's bring them into the office. Okay, so Hanani, Mishael, Azariah go with him. The Daniel Bishar Malka. Daniel is now in the court of the king, which in most cases means some kind of judge or officer in the court of the king, like Mordechai in the court of Achashverosh, and the Bishar HaMelech. That's the story in Perek Bet. So I've skipped the dream itself, and I've skipped Daniel's tefillah. We will come back to those issues in great detail. But I, for today, in the time remaining, and maybe we'll carry this over to next week a little bit, because it's always hard to begin. You have to kind of go through the story itself, and that takes time. But what I want to try to understand is two questions. What is the, or three questions. What is the nature of Nebuchadnezzar's dream? Sorry, just going to excuse me for 1 second. I need to get the sun out of my eyes. Apologize for 1 second. Sometimes it's a little bit too bright. Several questions that we need to address in this discussion. I want to go back to the beginning of the parak. What is the nature of this, of dreams in general? We have a very powerful experience, a very powerful story here. And I think it's a foregone conclusion. I think it's obvious, almost goes without saying, that there is a striking parallel here between the story of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, needing of interpretation, Daniel, who's able to interpret, attributes the interpretation to God, and suddenly Daniel is sitting in the service of the king. The story is so strikingly parallel to the story of
Yosef.
Yosef. I mean, it's just even the language is reminiscent, is very parallel to the story of Yosef, and we're going to talk about that parallel in a little bit. But there is, so there's this question of what role these experiences of the kings of extraordinary position and power having dreams and the introduction of the Jew or Israelite servant who, because of his ability to communicate with God and or to receive some kind of divine inspiration and interpretation, ends up being elevated into the service of the king. That's exactly what happened to Yosef, and that's precisely what happens to Daniel. So that in itself requires some understanding. What is the context here? What is the nature of the dream? Is the dream a kind of prophecy? Is the dream a kind of message, a mission? What's the nature of the dream? And it begs the second question, which is a question we need to address, we haven't addressed yet, which is, who or what is Daniel? Because this really puts us in a position to ask the question, is Daniel a Navi? Is Daniel a prophet? Daniel has a dream in which he receives a message from God. We call that prophecy. And that message includes the details that are hidden to any normal human being. So his form of communication seems to be that of a Navi. He himself will have great visions at the end of the parak, end of the sefer, where he has chazonot, he has visions of Daniel. Daniel has visions in which he sees the future of history. So those are clearly prophetic in nature. Does that make him a Navi? On the face of it, it sounds, the answer is yes. On the other hand, Daniel is a book written in Ketuvim and not in Nevi'im, and Daniel is Mechutza. Bechlal is questionable. What is Daniel's status? And by extension, what is the status of the prophecies that Daniel expresses in the context of is he a Navi or not a Navi? So those are the three questions. What is the nature of a dream altogether in terms of prophetic dreams of kings? What is the nature of Daniel? Is he a prophet? Is he not a prophet? What is he? And why is this dream happening to Nebuchadnezzar and by extension to Paro? And is there a difference between them? I actually want to start with an interesting observation. This phrase, Shnatstein Machut Nebuchadnezzar Chalam Nebuchadnezzar Chalamot Vatit Paem Rucho Ushnaton Yetalav. The ear to Nebuchadnezzar, he has a dream or dreams, and he's greatly troubled. His spirit was troubled. Vatit Paem Rucho. I come back here. So this is exactly the same phrase, right? This is the same Daniel Perek Bet from this website, Vatit Paem Rucho. I think it's a foregone conclusion that this is a phrase that, or we should hear the phrase, right? It should be familiar to us. If we haven't heard it recently, we're about to hear it in a couple of weeks. It's exactly the same language that we find in the story of Yosef when Paro's dreams begin, and here is Breshit Mem Aleph, and Paro has a dream, Mahimi Ketch Atayim Yamim. There's also a time frame here. It's an interesting issue. After 2 years, our story is also second year of Nebuchadnezzar. I hadn't really thought much about that, but that's just apparent, an aside. And, Paro Cholem, he has a dream, and we know he has two dreams because he dreams it a second time. Vayishan vayachalom shenit. And when he wakes up from these dreams, vayhi baboker, Vatipa'em lucho, and he is troubled. His heart pounding. Tipa'em lucho means his heart is beating. Right? Modern Hebrew, the heart beats. His heart is beating fast. Vatipa'em lucho. And that's exactly what it says by us. Vatipa'em lucho. His heart was beating. His heart was pounding. However, Rashi and many of the Mephoshim, based on primarily the Medrash, pick up on one oddity. It's comparisons in Tanakh are designed specifically to highlight differences. And that's a very important principle or foundation to understand. That there are many, many parallels throughout Tanakh. And in almost all of them, the goal is usually to highlight the small to medium to large nuanced differences between them. So wherein is the difference between Vatitpa Emrucho and in Vatitpa Emrucho in Nebuchadnezzar's case and Vatitpa Emrucho in Paro's case?
An extra tough.
It's Nifal and Hitpael.
Correct. Different binyan. Nifal and Hitpael. Okay. Significant, yes. Majorly significant, we'll see. Says Rashi, Vatitpa'em Rucho. What is the significance of this? And by, so Rashi on this pasuk says, Vaparo ne'amar Vatitpa'em Rucho. Vaparo, it's the same word. It's just a slightly different structure. Says Rashi, Shelo ne'alam imenu ela pitaron chalom. Paro knew the dream. Paro told the dream to his advisors. Right? That's exactly what it says. It says that Paro told the dream by the Bersar to all of the people. And by Saper Paro lehem et chalamo, Paro told them the dream, but they couldn't interpret it to his satisfaction. Ve'en potero to Paro. So Paro, Shalom ne'elam imenu ela pitaron chalom. Ve'kan ne'elam imenu gam chalom. Here, not only was the interpretation lost to him, but the dream itself was lost to him. And therefore, he had two elements that he had lost in that moment. Nichbela lashon. And therefore, the language is doubled. Vatitpa'em. Lashon pima, vahalima, the pulsating and beating. That's actually a side point. That's an editorial comment added to the Rashi. I'll leave that for now. In other words, there was an element of, there's an intensity here because he's lost, Nebuchadnezzar lost both the dream itself and the interpretation of the dream. In other words, what Rashi is alluding to is the fact that the significance of of Nebuchadnezzar's loss of the dream itself gets built into the worry that Nebuchadnezzar is experiencing. Ditva titpa'em lucho is hitpa'el and not nifal. And the difference is not just grammatical. Right? Binyanim in Hebrew have different connotations. They have different applications. What, nifal is binyan, binyan kal, hitpa'el is binyan kaved. Nifal is much lighter. He's bothered by it. He couldn't remember the dream. He couldn't identify the interpretation, but the dream he had. Nebuchadnezzar is much more vexed, much angrier. Right? Paro never threatened anybody. Paro was just going to his advisors and saying, interpret it for me. And nobody could. He didn't threaten anybody. Nebuchadnezzar threatened all of his advisors with death if they can't tell him his dream. You feel the intensity of Nebuchadnezzar. It's not just because Nebuchadnezzar is more intense. It's because the dream is more intense. Now, there is a substantive explanation in the dream itself, in the psychology of the dream, because what was Paro dreaming about? The end of the day.
Egypt. The future of Egypt.
Put it in perspective.
Economics.
Economics. A period of a decade and a half.
Hardship.
The tough times. Nothing. There is a solution. Yosef had the solution to the tough times. It wasn't something that threatened Paro. It threatened that it was meant that it was going to be tough for all the Egyptians. Paro tough, wasn't yes. threatened.
Tough, yes, but not destructive. Nothing in Paro's dream ever threatened Egypt permanently. There's nothing in Paro's dream that gave him the sense that what's at stake here is the destruction of Egypt. It was a challenge. What does 7 year mean? 7 seasons, 7 years, it was clearly an agricultural dream. It was clearly about seasons. It was clearly, you know, whatever the context was, Rashi was able, Yosef was able to interpret it and offer a solution, but it was limited in its scope. Nebuchadnezzar's dream, we haven't read yet. But it's acharit hayamim. It's eschatological. It's about the destruction of Babel. It's about what kingdom will replace this great empire that Nebuchadnezzar has just built. It's about Nebuchadnezzar being cut down into smithereens. It's about a great rock that represents the kingdom of heaven that will replace the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar. That is a much more vexing, much more troublesome, much more diabolical dream for Nebuchadnezzar, and therefore not surprising that Nebuchadnezzar's response to it was
make Syria MAGA, make Syria great again, make Assyria great again.
Well, he hasn't gone there yet. Right now he doesn't remember the dream. But why doesn't he remember the dream? And I would argue the reason he doesn't remember the dream is because it was so devastating that he's almost buried it deep in the subconscious. When you, the nightmare from which he awakens is so horrible that he literally buries it and he can't remember what it was. He remembers the emotion of it, but he can't remember the dream itself. And so that's Vatit Pe'em Rucho. This dream is extraordinary. It leads him to a point at which he says he's willing to threaten the lives of all of his chartumim, all of his advisors, because what's at stake here is a dream that is nothing short of an extraordinary exposition on the future of this great empire. And that's exactly what the Neil tells him. The Neil tells him that what's at stake here is the future of this empire, and ultimately what he can do about it. We'll see what that means, what the Neil represents or suggests to him. So this is the context in which this story begins, the contrast to the dream of Paro. Dream of Paro at the outset, at the most, was a 14-year challenge. Nebuchadnezzar's dream is literally is do or die, existential. And therefore, the significance is much greater. Which brings me to the question of what role Daniel plays in this story, and why, from a textual perspective, it's important that Nebuchadnezzar can't remember the dream, and Daniel enters into the conversation. So let's sort of digress for a minute, and let's spend a few minutes talking about the question that is discussed in the commentaries at length, which is the status of Daniel. What is the status of Daniel? Is Daniel a Navi or not? The fact that the book of Daniel is in Ketuvim would seem to indicate that it's one of the, you know, that there's a difference between books that are written and appear in Nevi'im and books that are in Ketuvim. In the language of Halacha, books that are written with prophecy in Nevi'im, their works are in Sifrei Nevi'im. And the works of Ruach HaKodesh, of divine inspiration, don't have the status of a Navi, but they are, you know, kind of communication of some kind, but not necessarily of a Navi, are in Ketuvim. This is a major debate amongst the Rishonim. The argument to support the notion that Daniel is in fact a Navi is articulated by the Abarvanel. I did not put it on the source page because it's a very long piece, and I didn't have it in translation. But the Abarvanel goes through at length an attempt to demonstrate that Daniel is in fact a Navi. And the primary proof that he uses is the historical accuracy with which Daniel describes future events. Daniel's description of, and we will see many of this towards the end of the Sefer, Mirtz Hashem, if we're able to get that far, is an extraordinary accurate description of the period of the Chashmonaim and the rebellion of the Chashmonaim against the Greeks, and the period of the various periods of history that the Midrash describes. And Rabbanel goes on to describe in great detail the historical accuracy of Daniel. He says that we're talking about the prophecies of Acharit Yamim. Daniel has conversations with Malachim. He has visions with the angels. The angels help him interpret those visions. These visions are foundational. They're part of our Masoret, of what Yevamot Mashiach will look like, but ultimately the whole eschatological vision of time is based around. And so, says the Abarvanel, clearly this must be Nevuah. On the other hand, the other end of the spectrum, I would argue the majority of Rishonim, Rashba, Rambam, vast majority of halachic positions, based on the Gemara as well, take the position that Daniel himself is not a Navi. And the biggest proof to that is that his book is written in Ketuvim and not in Nevi'im. And so he has the status of what the Gemara refers to as Ruach HaKodesh, or what the Rambam describes as Ruach HaKodesh. What does that mean? It's a little bit of a contradiction in the Rambam, but we're going to start with source 4. So the Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim. First, he talks about what is prophecy and the status of prophecy and the nature of prophecy. And then he talks about a second degree, one step below prophecy. Shimsa Adam Kiilu Inyan Echad Chal Alav Bekoach Acher Hitchadesh. A person feels as if something has come upon him, receives some kind of new power that encourages him to speak. And he speaks in wisdoms. tishbachot or b'divrei azhara or of hymns and exhortations to his fellow men, or binyanim hanhagiyim, or he discusses kind of political leadership issues, or lukiyim, or divine matters. Jumping to the top of the next column, v'ze kulo be'et hayikitsa, he's awake at this time. It doesn't have to be in a trance. Neviim fall in a trance, says the Rambam. Neviim have this experience which is physically overwhelming. Yishtemesh achushim al manhigehem. All his faculties are aware. And this says is what Chazal referred to when they referred to the concept of Ruach HaKodesh. Ruach HaKodesh, one step below prophecy. And this concept of Ruach HaKodesh is what enabled David to write Sefer Tehillim, and Shlomo to write Sefer Mishle, and Shlomo to write and Kohelet, and Shir HaShirim. Bechein Daniel ve'Iyov ve'Divrei HaYamim ve'Shar HaKtuvim, and similarly all of the rest of the books of Ketuvim, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, Iyov, Divrei HaYamim, all written with Ruach HaKodesh, but not Nevuah.
What we call wisdom literature, correct?
Wisdom, well, from they're in Tanakh, so they're slightly more than, yes, the Chochmei Emet, or the philosophical works of Tanakh, are included in this list, but so are Daniel and Divrei HaYamim, which are not books of philosophy, but they are written by people who are given this status of Ruach HaKodesh. There's a divine inspiration that infuses their words. It's one step removed from Nevuah. Why are they not Nevi'im? They could be Nevi'im in a different context in a different world. Daniel, had he been born a couple of generations earlier in the land of Israel with a Beit HaMikdash functioning, etc., it's possible that he could have been a Navi. But that wasn't the reality. He was a young child who grew up in Bavel. There's a famous comment of the Kuzari who says that you can't have prophecy in Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel. But unless you started as a prophet in Israel. So Yechezkel starts as a prophet in Israel, he goes to Bavel. Daniel, essentially born and bred in Bavel, can never attain a status of Nevuah. And therefore, David, Shlomo, Daniel, they are of this group. They're not of the same status as Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu and Natan and Achiah Shiloni and Eliyahu and others. Right, but they are in this context of having been works that have been written in Ruach HaKodesh.
I have a question. Does it make a difference that Daniel's was speaking and answering to the king, and he wasn't addressing Israel? He wasn't speaking to the people, to his people.
I mean, he will be addressing to the people later in the book. This is a conversation that's really overall about the whole context of the book. There are visions that Daniel has in chapter 10, for example. Ra'iti ani Daniel levadi et hamareh. I, Daniel, saw this vision. V'anashim ashayu imi lo ra'u, and the people who were with me, they didn't see this vision. I saw a vision of Marach, Charadah Gdola nafla lahem. They were greatly seized with terror and fled into hiding. But I saw this vision, I stood on my feet, and I saw this great vision. Chapter 10 is an extraordinary, chapter 10 and 11, extraordinary details of what Daniel saw. Vision of animals and different parts and different symbolisms and different nations, different periods of time. We will, Mir Hashem, hopefully get to that discussion. And the Gemara on that verse in Daniel, Perek Yud, says, who are the people who are with him? These are the Nevi'im, Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi. Those are the prophets of Bayit Sheni. Now, anachronistically, it's unlikely that Daniel actually kind of interacted with the prophets Chag HaZechariah and Malachi. They're much later in time. But conceptually, these were what the Gemara refers to as Nevi'im. And therefore, the Gemara says, Inu adif minei ve'yu adif minayu. They, in certain ways, they were greater than he, and in other ways, he was greater than them. They were greater than him because they were prophets, and he was not a prophet. But you love Navi. Daniel says the Gemara explicitly is not a prophet. But he was greater than them, that even though he wasn't a prophet, he could see the vision they couldn't. In other words, the fact that he's not a prophet doesn't mean he doesn't have the ability to see and understand. He has a great ability to see and understand. Ruach HaKodesh is very powerful. Ruach HaKodesh is very real. But it's one step down from Nevuah. Why is that significant for us? Why is that significant for us?
Isn't that what Rambam says, that Talmud Chacham is greater than a Navi, can be greater than a Navi?
So there's a third element, which is the Talmud Chacham, who is neither a Navi nor somebody who speaks Baruch HaKodesh. That's a Talmud Chacham whose strength comes from the study of the text and applied to it. This is different. Baruch HaKodesh is in the same mechanism as Nevuah. It's just one level down. Chacham Adif Minavi is a whole different issue. In that regard, a Chacham is better than a Ruach HaKodesh also, in the context in which that is addressed. But the issue here is one of I lowered the status of Daniel to somebody who has this kind of Ruach HaKodesh, divine spirit, who's with him and the ability to interpret these dreams, to give him the vision, but not in the context of Nevuah, but rather in the context of some kind of Ruach HaKodesh. Why is that significant for us? Because
he's not appointed formally as a Navi, and yet he takes the leadership on himself to try and save not only his friends, but also all the leaders in Bavel.
That is true. I know somebody else who's not a Navi, but who is given the ability through Ruach HaKodesh to interpret dreams that the ordinary human being is not able to do, and puts him in a position of unique wisdom and unique recognition by the king of the time. Anybody else come to mind in that regard?
Yosef.
And it's exactly, all of these indicators point to this constant theme of a comparison between Yosef and Daniel. Yosef was certainly not a prophet. Nevi'im, Yosef certainly didn't have Nevuah. He had Hashem Vayayimo. God was with him. He had Ruach HaKodesh. He had the ability to interpret, to see, to perceive. And that's exactly what Daniel had, an ability to interpret, an ability to receive this kind of experience and to convey it to the level of Ruach HaKodesh. Why that's significant in the story, we're going to see in a second, because I want to come to, at the end of the shiur today, a foundational distinction between Yosef and Daniel. But it's important to recognize in the outset that Daniel's role here is as close to a Navi as you can get, but not yet there. He's not in the context of a Navi, but he's as close to it. Ruach HaKodesh. Ruach HaKodesh is very powerful, right? It's very real. He has real visions. He has real communications with Malachim. By the way, anybody know identifiable names of Malachim? We have several identifiable names that we have in our tradition of angels.
Gabriel,
Michael.
Michael.
Do you know how we know those names?
Yeah. Hamalach ha-go'el oti mikol, when we sing.
Yeah, but that doesn't name them. Hamalach ha-go'el oti mikol is in the Chumash, but it doesn't name them.
Ah, you see.
Where do we have the names? Michael, Rifael. Who named the Malachim? Who saw them so clearly that you could identify them by name?
Yechezkel.
Yechezkel doesn't name them.
Daniel.
We'll see it at the end of the Sefer. Daniel names them. He has visions. He has communications with them. He talks to them. The Malach Gavriel came to me. The Malach Michal came to me. They have different roles. The roles of the Malachim. Daniel is an extraordinary vision. But it's in Ketuvim because it's Ruach HaKodesh. Now, as a polemic, this is very important because Daniel is one of those books that ends up being a very significant polemic between Jews and other faiths that use the book of Daniel to support the chronology of their God or Savior. Daniel plays a very large role in Christian theology. And for that reason, they included Daniel when they include the Hebrew Bible in their Bible, they include Daniel in the books of the prophets, not the books of Ketuvim. Because to them, Daniel has to be a prophet because he's a proof to their theology in their interpretation of it. So this issue becomes for us a very big polemic and we'll explore it much more detail at the end of the Sefer. But assuming that that is the case, and assuming that this is not Nevuah, but in fact some kind of Ruach HaKodesh vision or mission or insight, that brings us to the second question that I asked at the outset, which is, so what is the nature of the dream? Why are these kings having dreams that these people with Ruach HaKodesh then have to interpret? And here we enter into a really fascinating question. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this question because it's you know, sort of one of those things that like Elu ve'Elu, they're both right, which is a dream. How is Jewish tradition's understanding of what the role of a dream is? You know, all familiar with the concept of a tanit chalom. You have a bad dream, you special fast days and special tefillot that you say in response to the to these dreams. In other words, we see dreams as being more than just a kind of a momentary expression of the subconscious. Right? There's actually two opinions in the Gemara. There's a Gemara in Brachos that says that Amar Shmuel Nachmani Amar Rav Yonatan Ein Marino LaAdam Ela Mihu Libo, that a dream at night is a reflection of what one thinks about during the day. Which is a very advanced psychological insight, foundation of all of Freudian psychology. Or much of it. Shenema ant malka rayoncha al mishkavcha sliku. Right? And based on the text in Daniel, your thoughts came upon your bed. You were thinking about the future. And so you had a dream about what you thought the future would look like. On the other hand, the same Gemara says that chalom echad mishishim lenevuah. That a dream is 1/60th of prophecy. And therefore, a dream has a significant component to a message involved. That's certainly what Paro thought, and the repetition of the dream gave him that message. That's certainly what Nebuchadnezzar thought. And hence his turn not to the psychologists of the day, or the counselors of the day, but to the magicians and the soothsayers and the necromancers and the astrologers, because he's looking for not only the dream, but what it means. And most of the dreams in Sefer Daniel are interpreted to be some kind of insight or prophecy about what the future holds. And so that's the context here. Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar. Dreams about what their future will look like, a message from God, if you will, that they can't interpret. And in walks Yosef or Daniel, in the power of Ruach HaKodesh, to interpret those dreams and to give them the insight to help them navigate through this future. I'm going to skip the rest of this page because it's not really relevant to us for now, but there's a fascinating discussion in the Rishonim as to the difference between a prophet who prophesizes with Nevuah and a prophet of Ruach HaKodesh who prophesizes with dreams. And the profound difference Yirmiyahu already identifies is that dreams are powerful, but they're not explicit. They're not complete. There's always some elements of the dream that are true, elements of the dream that are not true. There's always an embellishment. Unlike prophecy, which is very specific, dreams are more generic, metaphorical in that regard. Which brings me to the question with which I started. So we've established essentially three things. That Nebuchadnezzar and Paro's dream, on some level, is significant and certainly perceived as significant to some kind of prophecy, some lower level of prophecy or experience that they are having, and the need for somebody to come in and give them that guidance and interpretation, in this case, Yosef and Daniel, who share the status of not being prophets in the classic sense of the term, but certainly being this kind of Ruach HaKodesh people, somebody with the insight to pray to God to give him an interpretation and answer, and then to be able to share that beyond. Okay, I'm going to stop sharing here for a second, which brings me to the core of my question. The core of my question is, and we have literally 60 seconds left to put it on the table, So what is the foundational difference between Nebuchadnezzar's dream and Yosef's dream and Paro's dream vis-a-vis Daniel and Yosef? In other words, coming back to the question with which we started, Nebuchadnezzar forgets the dream. Daniel has to share with him both the dream and its interpretation. Paro doesn't forget the dream. He knows the dream. All Yosef has to do is share with him the interpretation. Why is the story laid out in that fashion? After all the comparisons between Yosef and Daniel, one profound difference lies at the heart of those two stories, and all of these little pieces point in that direction.
The education of the bringing up between the two is much different.
That's true. The background starts differently.
We were started with the first parak that he tried really to put them in the setup mind and like to convert them or to simulate them. So here's the challenge is much bigger to Daniel than the challenge to Yosef.
I hear what you're saying. And there's truth, and there's a great truth to that. But that's not essentially, doesn't answer the question of what the dream represents, because the dream is a message. So let me ask you the question. Let me ask the question differently. And we're running out of time. So let me just summarize it.
Okay.
What is the purpose of the dream? Or to put it differently, to whom is the dream directed?
To the kings.
Wait. Let me explain my question. Let me explain the answer. To whom is the dream directed? In Yosef's case, in Paro's case, the dream is conveyed to the king, but the purpose of the dream is not for the king. The goal of the dream in Yosef's case, in Paro's case, that dream had one goal. And that goal was to bring Yosef into the palace. The dream itself, Paro knew. And the truth is, if you look at the dream itself and you look at the interpretation that Yosef gives it, it's pretty clear. Seven agricultural cycles, seven cows. It doesn't take rocket science to figure out the dream. Yosef's wisdom was not in figuring out what the dream meant. Yosef's wisdom was in his chutzpah, if you will, to interpret and give a suggestion, a mode of behavior, a plan, an economic plan, which is what drives Paro to say, hey, this guy is beyond brilliant. Because not only did he interpret the dream, but he gave an economic plan that would save us from this calamity. And he brings Yosef out of prison and into the position of viceroy of Egypt, where Yosef is now in a position to address the brothers and bring the brothers down to Mitzrayim and save the story. It's all about Yosef. Paro is irrelevant. Paro is a vehicle. The story is about Yosef. And the purpose of the dream is to bring Yosef into the kingdom. The message is not for Paro. The message is for Yosef. Paro is the vehicle. In Nebuchadnezzar's case, it's the exact opposite. This is a message about an eschatological vision of the future, of the fall of Babel, of the kingdoms that will replace it, of the kingdom of God that will replace the restoration of the Jewish people. This is not a message for Daniel. Daniel knows all of this. This is a message for Nebuchadnezzar. The message is directed to Nebuchadnezzar, which means that's why he has to forget it. Because when Daniel walks into his palace, think about the vision for a second. Daniel is now conveying to Nebuchadnezzar the message itself and the dream itself and its interpretation. Daniel is teaching Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel is speaking to the king. It's like a classic structure of all the classic Nevi'im. The prophet speaks to the king and tells him what the future will be. That's the role of a prophet. That's exactly what you have in that moment when Daniel says to the king, your vision, your experience, this is what it means for the future days, the end of time. The message is for Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel is the conveyor of the message. Whereas in Paro's case, the message is for Yosef and Paro is the conveyor of the message. So the two dreams are actually operating in opposite directions because they have different roles, they're different purposes. Hang on one second. Let me just finish the sentence because I'm running out of time. And I'll take questions afterwards after we've kind of officially ended. You're welcome to stay on and ask questions. But therefore, that brings us to the last question, which we're not going to answer today. But I have to leave you with a cliffhanger or you won't come back. And that is, why is it that Nebuchadnezzar, of all people, is Zoche, if you want to put it in those terms, to a prophecy of the future and the end of time, of Yemot HaMashiach, something that Nevi'im weren't Zoche to? What did the Nebuchadnezzar do to deserve this great covet of Daniel Baruch HaKodesh telling him this Nevuah of what the future of the Jewish people will be and the future destiny of Israel? Paro's vision was 14 years into the future. Nebuchadnezzar's vision, according to the majority of Rishonim, is into the future history of the world. What did Nebuchadnezzar do to merit that kind of vision? That part two of this discussion we will have next week. I'm going to officially close here. People who want to stay on and ask questions, I have time. I'm welcome to. I just don't want to keep people past the time that we have already assigned. So I will officially end here. We will pick up this discussion next week. If people have questions, by all means.
Okay, can I ask you, is Mordechai perhaps a comparable to in status to Daniel?
Yes, I would say yes. There is some discussion as to who Mordechai is and his role and whether or not Mordechai is one of the Nevi'im or just one of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, but the language parallels between Daniel and Mordechai are very striking. Daniel, it says, Daniel betra malka b'shar hamelech, and of Mordechai, it says, Mordechai yoshev b'shar hamelech. And they're both, one's in Persia, one's in Bavel, but Persia takes over for Bavel. It's the same region. It's the same language. I think Mordechai is very much a similar role to Daniel.
According to what you just explained, what benefit Melech Bavel has by knowing our future?
Oh, so that you'll have to go back to next week. That we'll have
okay,
to.
Okay, no, because it's fascinating your analogy, but I don't see it in this stage, so I will wait for next week.
I will. That is exactly the question we need to look at next week. Why Nebuchadnezzar, Melech Bavel, gets this vision of what the future of Israel holds, of all people? So, yes, we will explore that in detail. Yes, Esther.
Okay. I have a technical question. I came into the lecture a little late. I want to know how to get to the recording. It says here it's recording, but I have absolutely no idea of how to get to it.
Okay. Are you able to get into the chat?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Maybe. I'm going to put a link on the chat.
Okay.
It's basically the same page that has the source pages and that has the registration link. If you scroll down to the bottom of the page, you'll see the source page is posted and the video is posted.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay.
So, okay.
It's also on the YouTube channel for Torah in Motion, but it's certainly on that page.
It'll take a day or so to put it up.
Correct. It takes a few days to put up, but the previous weeks are there already.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
No problem. Okay, we have people raise their hands. Susanna?
Yes. Within his context, Paro is a god in Egypt. Is the god Netzar also a god in
That's interesting. I don't know enough about Babylonian culture to answer that question. You certainly... part of the goal in much of the Sefer is to bring Nebuchadnezzar to the humility to acknowledge and recognize God, our God. Is he himself a deity in Babylonian culture? Interesting. They have lots of deities. Is the king also considered a deity? I'd have to research that.
I mean, certainly that's an issue with Paro, to recognize Hashem.
True, correct. And then that's certainly, Shira is on the call and she says she's happy to help navigate the website and anybody needs help. So just reach out to her. Yes, there's another hand up. Is it?
Yes. Earlier when you, one of the sources said that, Tillim and the Sorim of Shlomo were written Beruach HaKodesh, but they were unquestionably in Vim. So what is it? They came down in level to
Rambam would argue they're not in Vim.
I thought they're listed as one of the 48 Nevi'im, no?
It could be, but the Rambam would argue not. That source very explicitly, the Rambam says they're in the status of Ruach HaKodesh, not Nevi'im.
I'll have to check the sources again. Okay. Yeah,
the Rambam's very clear about that, that he puts them into the category of Ruach HaKodesh, not Nevi'im.
Okay. We'll have to check. Thank you.
Yeah. Which makes sense if you think about the role of the Nevi'im in their communication to the kings, right? So it's the Navi who criticizes the king. David is, in that sense, they have moments of prophetic experience. Shlomo has a dream in Givon, in which God comes to him, again, more likely in the context of a vision, of a chazon, of some other hands that are up. I'm happy to stay for as long as you want. I just want to make sure that nobody's obligated to stay because we're past our time, but you're welcome to stay on the call. Usher, did you have a question? I see your hand up.
Yeah, I wanted just in the same context, what is it true about Shaul as well when he joins the Chevel Nevi'im and perhaps even to a greater extent, Eldad and Medad?
I'd have to go back and analyze that a little more in detail. By Eldad and Medad, I would say no. Eldad and Medad are included part of the Sanhedrin and get from the Atzilata Ruach of Moshe. So I think that that's certainly not in that lower level.
Let's go back to Shaul and the Chevel Nevi'im.
Shaul and Nevi'im, Shaul is certainly not somebody who I would want to put into the category of a Navi. I think that that's part of the story, is that he has this temporary experience of a prophetic, not a message, but a experience. Meaning, Lehitnabe is different than Linnabe. Hitnabe is a prophetic experience, a kind of an overwhelming trance that pulls the choir of the Nevi'im together. Shaul is described as having been pulled up into that trance that surprises everybody. Agam Shaul b'Nevi'im, right? Suddenly he's amongst that group. Does that make him a Navi? I don't think so. It gives him a taste of what the experience of the school of prophecy is about. Why it's there, I would say, is two reasons. Number one, because the context of that story, which is Sefer Shmuel, so it's completely out of a different field. But the context of that story is to do two things. Number one, to convey to Shaul that he's not just a shepherd anymore, and that as he merges or moves into Venev Pachta Le'ish Acher, is the language of the Navi, the message. You are transformed. You are more than you were before, and you need to recognize that. It also helps him understand the role of the Navi, because he has a taste of what the Nevi'im live by, and part of Shaul's problem and part of the messaging to him at that moment is that the king has to listen to the Navi, and so he gets his taste of what the experience of the Nevi'im is like without necessarily the status of a Navi, and that makes him theoretically more amenable to listening to the Nevi'im, which unfortunately in his case doesn't quite work to his benefit.
Thank you.
That I think is the context there. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you for listening. Thank you for staying 15 more minutes extra just to kind of have this conversation. I'm happy to do it, but I don't want anybody to feel obligated. We will stop here and thank you. We will see you, B'ezrat Hashem, next week.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.